Ms. Ann Kelly of Microsoft is going to speak about practicing effectively in the patent marketplace. Vast years of experience, which will now be distilled into 45 immortal minutes.
I am so delighted to be here and to talk about this subject. It's something of a perfect subject for me to talk about because it's an evolutionary market and something that's emerging. This market of patents that underpins, you know, these new and big assertions that are happening and also new factors in the marketplace like the defensive aggregators. All of those sorts of trends are dependent on more of a patent sale marketplace. But really, because it's an emerging marketplace and Microsoft has only really been in the patent and the patent licensing business for a certain period of time, I've kind of been able to observe both us become involved in the overall patent marketplace and watch this marketplace evolve. So it is something that it really is an evolution from the past. As we all know, patents were often just held for, you know, a competitive advantage, and that was the main thing. And then some people thought, well, you know, let's clear risks more proactively, and there was cross-licensing in certain industries. And cross-licensing is a good way to get started thinking about the value of patents in the aggregate and in a very objective way, because you evaluate your own, you evaluate others, you evaluate the market. And I think it was a good learning ground to get thinking about how to transact more broadly. At the same time, then licensing really began. It was time to start the value creation. And so from the 80s on, we had these patent cross-licenses and this licensing market that was growing and growing and growing. And now, you know, it's kind of to the next place. It's a place where we're saying, okay, there are a lot of patents out there. We still have the same issues about risk. And we still have value extraction and creation we want to do. But can we do it in new and different ways? And it's not to say that patents haven't been transacted in the past. Of course they have. But they are being transacted more broadly. So my work in preparation for this conference was to try and bring a little bit of a business perspective. I did run the intellectual property licensing business, although I stopped 2 years ago. So I have been enjoying the support of, and cooperation with colleagues and getting some information, as well as others in the industry whom I've known. First, I want to just kind of talk about what is this marketplace and have a dialogue about that. I think there are people in the room, and Mark certainly has done a lot of research, and I've read papers that indicate that others have varying perspectives of this particular marketplace, and I'd love to hear about that. But I did talk to a lot of people in the industry who are poised to know where the transactions are going and what they look like. So first, talking about kind of money and where it is or may be, and then the number of patents at issue and what's going on by way of trends in the market. The next thing is, this is a marketplace that people have complained about in certain regards, because maybe there's not enough transparency, or wow, it's just really hard to transact in patents. Maybe it's a little easier to do a license because it's not maybe as much money, as big of an investment or risk, but when the returns are so high, people want to know how to do this better and better and are learning ways to do it better and better. And there's some controversy about various aspects of that that I'd like to bring out and begin to suggest some ways that we can improve the marketplace, because improving the marketplace and gaining that experience is going to underpin a more fully functioning marketplace and potentially some more efficient results. So that's kind of there. But then the part of me, and I was laughing because there was a comment just prior to the session about, oh, this conference is so great, you know, better, so much better than the ones with the practicing lawyers. I come to you then with the practicing lawyer viewpoint, because I don't know, you know, doing deals is hard. And when you're on the front lines, there are issues that face you. And there's particular issues in this area that not all have been completely thought through. Some are quite nagging and constant. Some are quite difficult, you know, and involve recent Supreme Court precedent to think through effectively. And it is hard for the practitioner. So getting beyond the complexity of valuation, getting beyond the scientific complexity of any particular patent, certainly in the industry in which I have worked, you still have some serious legal complexity about how to document your deal. And I think that for my main message to a practitioner audience would be, look, you have to understand the market and you have to understand the challenges so that you can engineer self-help in effect for you and for your client. But it's a lot to understand and it's not easy yet. So that's the purpose of where I'm going. And I first, you know, wanted to start with the billions. And these are not, you know, it's very difficult to get information in this marketplace about what's really happening. I have seen and talked to people about what they think the global patent licensing, for this conference's purposes, not patent licensing, the global IP licensing numbers are. And people say that it's in excess of $90 billion. Other people say it's hundreds of billions of dollars. I don't know what it is. And I'm not so sure that my $10 billion figure is perfect either for pure patent licensing, but I and colleagues and people I've spoken to feel like that may be about right. For just
all industries?
Yes. Of patent licensing, pure patent, no technology, just the naked patent license. I mean, I don't know about the pharma industry, if that's fully inclusive of that. So I would say anything broadly in the IT sector, it certainly includes. And in terms of pharma, if there are huge billion-dollar deals, maybe I'm not accounting for those. But to the key point for a practitioner is usually you're not doing naked patent transactions, but the trend is now you are. So it's trying to understand how many of those transactions are really taking place. That's exactly right. We're talking about transacting in patents for cash, not the wash or the evaluation, which, by the way, is my favorite topic. And you know, so anyway, if you take that number, then you think about it. There is a figure from Kevin Barheit from RPX, and he says he believes that there are $6 to $8 billion currently backing existing assertions. So that's an interesting figure to think about. That means that in patent lawsuits that are in process right now by non-practicing entities, he believes that there are $6 to $8 billion of capital behind the companies that are making those assertions. So I mean, think about these figures, about the needle in the haystack factor when you consider this. And then if you think about US patent infringement awards, this is a number that was done by IP360, and I couldn't find before today a number that was more recent. I'm sure there I can find when I for the publication of the paper a better figure. But the idea is $3.5 billion in actual awards in the United States for patent awards, and this is in the IT sector only. And then by all accounts, and we have had the opportunity to view the work of an Oliver Wyman study on this, we assess the patent marketplace, the exchange of patents for cash, to be at about, we've heard that it is about $1.3 billion. And everybody I've talked to in the industry, some said, oh, maybe it's more like 1.5. Maybe it's a little less. You know, the recession hit things, but it's growing again. But that's the number that comes out there. So you do think, when you're thinking about the billions, that $1.3 billion is really not that much to underpin, you know, 10 awards of over $100 million in the last 5 years. So that, with that perspective, let's look at the millions. And we'll talk a little bit about, am I blocking the yeah, okay. So on the millions, basically, we know that there have been a lot of patent awards over $100 million in the last few years. And you know, not all of them have made their way all the way through the appeals. Our company is particularly recognizes that sometimes you get relief on the back end, but in the meantime, there are some very big awards that are out there. You know, and then the median patent awards, according to this is Price Waterhouse, for the last 14 years, have been about $4.4 million across all industries. Now, if you look at software and telecom, respectively, I think it's 8.5 and 13.4, respectively, in terms of the median patent award in the United States.
And the means, are they much higher?
I don't remember. Yes. Yes, they were. They are
higher. A lot higher.
Like 20 or something?
Yes, there's a lottery effect.
Yeah.
Exactly. All it takes is one big one to offset a lot of them.
Yeah. That's right. So the price of 1% of the patents in the market, meaning these patents that are all being transacted out there, and you know, we sometimes estimate there are like 700,000 technology patents that might be in the marketplace. The price of 1% of the markets is going to be over $1 million. So there aren't very many valuable patents, but there are a lot of patents out there. How do you find the needle in the haystack? And then your garden variety patent, and I've heard in the last week in some follow-up conversations I've had, actually, garden variety patents aren't even selling. I mean, they're just not selling. It's over with the garden variety patents because this marketplace, which has grown over the last few years, it started 8 or 9 years ago to kind of, you know, to come along and grow. The Ocean Tomo auctions and a bit of frenzied buying by intellectual ventures and many others sort of took place 2000 to 2008. 2008, we have the financial correction. Things dropped off pretty much completely. And then things have come back. Talking to Ocean Tomo, they said that their auction last summer was $1.5 million, and this spring it was $15 million, so they're back 10 times from before. I'll talk a little bit later about auctions and you know where they may be going or not going, according to people in the industry. Yep?
Just two very quick questions. Mm-hmm. 6 to 8 billion number.
the capital?
On the capital backing enforcement number.
Yes.
If you think about the notion that if you're actually going to lawyer up, right? If you're actually going to go to court and enforce, you're going to be looking at least $10 million in kind of decent legal fees, and it could easily be 50. Then you're talking about a portfolio of 600 cases, and this is actually call money, not money on the table. So just for context, I think people react to this $6 billion and they think it's a little kind of unbelievable, but when you think about just the practical side of actually mounting any meaningful defense of your own patent, you're going to have to find a pool of investors. They're going to want to diversify their portfolio, and a 600-item portfolio is actually not very diverse. And then on your million chart, a recent question posed to a recent senior government official about these numbers in the IP competition space asked the question, is it possible that there is some patent that covers some technology that is of sufficient value as a technological matter, unrelated to lock-in effects, that it's actually kind of in the range of 10 to the 8th or 10 to the 9th in value.
Yeah.
And the answer was absolutely that's impossible. So I think that if you have, and that was, I think, a good faith answer.
Yeah.
So these valuation numbers, I think, reveal a lot about people's priors, about whether they think kind of it's conceivable that something could be worth that much, or it's inconceivable that something could be worth that much. And then they either see this data as low or high, but you'll get a huge variance.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there are a few things that you've touched on. One, I actually, you know, from a lot of sources, people have said it costs $3 to $5 million to bring the lawsuit. Now, in a very high-profile lawsuit, it might be something else, but I've gotten data and published data, other kinds of data, and I think that's more in that range. But still, it's a significant investment. And remember, every time you go out, you have the potential for eliminating the value of your patent completely, because you may have chosen wrong, you just have risk that's associated with that. So that's part of the bet that's behind all of this, of finding the needle in the haystack, and I think that's a key portion. The other thing is that, you know, in speaking with people, a comment was made, you know, the single biggest problem for a buyer in this market is that the sellers all think their patents are so valuable, and they're just not. And so, you know, the level of scrutiny that you're going to apply, and this is why this costs so much, to evaluate a patent that you're going to pay a lot of money for is extremely high. And that's why there have been sort of these two tiers. Well, some people say there are three, but these two tiers of sort of the lower value patents that kind of get transacted more quickly and easily, all still with, you know, a fair amount of transaction cost. And then the higher ones that everybody's trying to find the needle in the haystack. But I think your points are great, Scott, and I'll look forward to evaluating that a little bit more. It is again, the perceptions on both sides of the transactions and the marketplace are difficult to penetrate. And that's why it's most interesting to talk to people who both buy and sell. I think that that's been helpful. Well, with the numbers aside, let's go in and see who is in the marketplace. And basically, you got a lot of different kinds of buyers. But as many people in the room know, and many people in the room have even spent time on, you know, a lot of the new buyers are the non-practicing entities. I won't use the T word, But I will just say that, you know, people who, this is defining for people who might not know, these are people who don't have a business that they are running that might be associated with the kind of patented technology they are enforcing or utilizing. And those entities can be working on generating revenue both from licensing and from litigation, and usually it's a combination. I mean, obviously, licensing is a lot easier than litigation, but obviously, if you're trying to validate and ensure that you're going to have a very healthy long licensing stream, you're going to probably have to litigate, maybe have to litigate a few times. When I think about the patent assertion firms and the growth of them, I think there's some interesting figures. You know, the non-practicing entities now are we view and understand from this Oliver Wyman study, it's 80% of the market by transactions. 80% of the market by transactions and 60% of the market by value.
These are outright purchases.
Yes, of pure patents. This is all I'm talking about. And, you know, the assertion assertions form 20% of the market by value and number of transactions both. So the non-practicing entities may not be asserting, but they are the buyers. They are buying. So then you get into the next set of people, which are the defensive aggregators. And these are people who will buy as many patents as possible to take them off the table and license them to other people. They have constituents in various forms, and the structures of various entities are different. But, you know, you take an example of an AST, Allied Security Trust, and, you know, their model is what we call a catch and release model. So, you know, by and large, and not in all cases, they will try and get a patent, and then they will license all their constituents, and then the next thing they will do is try and sell the patent for as much money as possible. And sometimes they do better than they did when they bought, and sometimes they have to take a loss, but they have gotten this license for this group who never has to worry about it again. And as we're learning from a variety of sources, you know, the patents in these marketplaces, the ones that Mark has found are most litigated, have all been sold. I mean, they've all had a history of moving hands. And so this is part of the phenomenon that we're going to see more and more places where the patent has been. And I'll mention later on the practical aspects how this impacts your next sale. Intellectual ventures can speak for itself in many ways, but I thought it would be, you know, useful to reflect some comments and to direct you to Nathan Myhrvold's pretty recent kind of, it's not a manifesto, but it is a here's who we are paper in the Harvard Business Review. And, you know, where he makes clear some things that I think a lot of people didn't know until recently, which is that, you know, they have about 30,000 patents, most of which they've bought. That $5 billion in capital has been supportive of some of those acquisitions. And, you know, I think, you know, they also view themselves to be a little bit different from either being a defensive aggregator or being someone who is doing assertion licensing, both of which they do, because their view is that they are creating a market for inventions. Some of the money, I think they have more than 500 patents, which they have generated as a result of funding research as part of the support of the money. But it's an interesting article, and they are kind of sui generis, and I recommend it to you to learn a little bit more about that entity. Now, the operating companies, the people like Microsoft or smaller companies which operate and have patents and do business in the area where their patents are, those companies only form 20% of the transactions, but 35% of the value in this market, according to the study that I referred to. And, you know, most, you know, again, most people, why are practicing companies selling? Well, they're buying, they get into the marketplace, they start to be more critical and thoughtful about how they evaluate their overall portfolio. They get smarter. And they see they're not going to go in a certain direction that they thought they were going to go before. And they're going to extract value earlier rather than later. Some companies, and I have some support from this in literature from within the industry, you know, some was just plain old cash. I mean, even though it was a rough market for patent sales during the recession, there are some people who are selling them. The interesting thing is, you know, if you talk to anybody, what are the most valuable patents? The most valuable patents, if you're going to say, as a type. And they are the ones in bankruptcy. And I have a short war story. I negotiated our cross-license with Nortel. And I remember thinking, you know, we had some dramatic moments in the negotiations because Nortel was very excited about the value of its portfolio. We were doing our best to negotiate the right kind of deal. And there was a moment at which a very, very large number was put out on the table, and I'm not one of these who walks out of the room, but I did have to kind of pack the bag and go. And they did run out the hall after me. And we did complete a deal. But it was one of those situations when I thought, wow, this is scary how their business is doing. And I'm not gonna do this deal if it's not financially sound, but I would really like to do this deal. Because you see the value of those patents and you see that this company is not doing well. So bankruptcy is absolutely the best place to get a patent, according to everybody in the industry. That, I mean, they get very excited. The Commerce One patents were very, very valuable. And then the other ones are just when you are spinning off or getting rid of businesses, those patents are usually quite valuable because they've been associated with something and there has to have been a competitor, probably the reason why you're getting out of the business in the first place. But now let's talk about the little bit, in a way, more interesting part of the market, and that is who is helping people to do things in the marketplace. You know, you have the brokers. And the broker transactions now represent 75% of all of the transactions. Only 25% of the transactions are direct between entities. So they are a very influential group. And they are a group that I want to talk about in terms of the challenges and problems and opportunities in the marketplace. The auction part of the marketplace is represented about 10%, according to folks and estimates and studies. And many people view that is no longer going to be as strong a force. I think in many ways it was a market helped to facilitate this market as a whole by bringing people together. But the idea of people bidding against each other in a room is quickly going by the wayside, and all the main transactions, as with many auctions, are happen either before or after the auction takes place. So, you know, that even from Ocean Tomo, I think they would recognize that. Because people don't want to have an open auction. They would rather learn. They like learning about the patents out there, but that's not how they're going to transact in it.
Well, I mean, I understand they don't like it because they're not doing it, but what's the reason they don't like it?
Because
they have to reveal too much of their own business plans. Is that
that's right, and they don't want anybody else to know what they want, and they don't want anybody to know what they're going to pay. Because once you're in an auction, you're bidding. So that's actually a limiter in this marketplace, and it goes towards this important issue of transparency, which I'll address in just a moment. Then the online clearinghouse, and this is sort of an interesting thing. You know, if you think about real estate, if you think about many markets, it's so easy to say it's so impossible to do a transaction online and commoditize this. Patents have to be much harder because of the unique nature and their context. And how can you value something or price it? Even if you, I mean, how can it be have any relevance in a valuable patent marketplace? And I think my sense is it will be very difficult for it to come to that. Just as the high real estate values, the very high values are kind of handled in a slightly separate way. But there have been people who have been wanting two things for an online marketplace. They want more transparency to be able to see what's out there. That's the problem is you don't know what's there to buy. Even if you didn't see the price, they would be happy just to know more what is on market. And then the other thing that people have talked about in this after the previous sessions, you might find this interesting, is there are groups of people who are debating, you know, do we want some kind of, you know, template or standard terms, or are there things that we could just take some of the friction and transaction costs out by suggesting this is a way to transact? And I have never found it more interesting in terms of, like, the conversation in the room and then the conversation out of the room than those conversations. The minute you hear let's find a template and let's do this, and then everybody walks out of the room and says, that sounds great, but I'm not giving my stuff. And that was around and across the board. So I would say that this is a marketplace, again, seeking more transparency and ways to reduce transaction costs, but unlikely to do it via that mechanism, just as with the auction, for some of the same reasons. All right. Challenges in the marketplace, I mean, the contextual nature of valuation and patents is so hard. I don't know that with the time we have that I'm going to spend a ton of time on that, as important as it is, except to kind of segue to talk about the quality of evaluation of a patent is a key thing, and then the quality of data that talks about value is another key thing. So both in your work and then Colleen Shen's work, and then I'm forgetting this Toronto economist who's writing about transacting in patents and what's going to make a patent most likely to move. All the work suggests that citations, there's some indicia of what's right. You know, are they citing scientific papers? How often are they cited? You know, and those kinds of pieces come together to help people to look at what makes a valuable patent. And some of these studies are very good at tracking how that moves. How do you put that into practice when you're actually talking about evaluation of a particular patent? And then, if you're a company that is doing all assertions, you're going to have a certain view about the risks you're going to take and where you're going to put your money and your effort, and which patent might be relatively more valuable or better to go after based on either the market or the patent itself. If you're a company like Microsoft, or like many companies who have a broad and varied interest, might buy and sell patents, license in and license out, how do you then rationalize this? So I'm going to just show you something that we have created. Horacio Gutierrez, our intellectual property corporate vice president, basically read Moneyball, and he said, you know what? Billy Bean and the Oakland Athletics have an idea. And it's, in a way, people are more like patents than almost anything else. I mean, we think real estate's unique, and it is, but people are even more unique because they can, you know, they have life experiences, so to speak, that kind of change them in ways that are, I guess real estate does too, but that are important. And so his theory was, people in baseball were always talking about the wrong attributes, kind of the common lore and knowledge, but they weren't talking about the things that were really predictive of what was going to make a big difference. And so the idea is, what are the things that we do, and what are the things that would make a big difference? What are the tactics? What are the things that we need to evaluate the quality of? And then how can we create a system, a framework, that will contemplate that and let us make decisions in a more effective way? So it's part taxonomy. The first thing is to get your goals and your tactics. So an example would be, you know, support law reform. It would be out-license patents. Portfolio analysis. It's almost like a capability study. If you've ever done operational work or you're trying to change what you're doing, it's kind of like, what are the things we do and how do we put those in buckets? And if there's, you know, in our case, I think there's something like 30 or 33 or something, things that we think we do in the IP area. You know, create patents. If you take those things and put them together, and then you put the next piece on, which is, what is the value of those activities to you? So even law reform, or, you know, which might have a potent value if law reform comes out in a way that is positive for you in a defensive context. But then what do you lose in the offensive context? And you have to think through each of these things. And then finally, it's an optimization and prioritization. And here is where you have the secret sauce. So every big player in the patent marketplace is trying to use algorithms in different ways to figure out what's right and what's best. I mean, machines are very, very helpful in figuring out this information once you have the data sets and the input. And I think we are no different. And so we took, sort of from the Moneyball perspective, we decided, okay, what are the things we want to measure? How are we going to put the framework together? And then how will we use this to become more predictive? And so it creates a prioritization. The things that are going to have the best return on investment, we're going to prioritize. And we're going to optimize our strategy around that and optimize each of our tactical efforts around the right assets.
But so, can I ask you a question about this? Which is, I mean, we're seeing this stuff. And I guess the first question I'm curious about is, these are all pure sales cases as opposed to pure licensing cases.
Absolutely.
Right? And I would have thought that the optimization model that you just put on the board, that three-stage process, would work every bit as well with respect to licensing as it would to sales.
It does. And let me just show you up here on the slide, and I'll get out of its way. It's kind of low here. But basically, if you say enterprise value creation is a number of things. Number one, we have to think about, you know, what is the financial return we could get from something? You know, first we have the cost. What is the financial return we could get? What is the defensive avoidance? What is the risk avoidance, meaning if I have to change my software product because I lose? So the defensive there is, what do I pay as a result of a patent judgment? Then the risk is, what am I avoiding otherwise by way of transaction costs or costs? And then the competitive value, of course, is, you know, how does holding this patent or enforcing this patent or help me from a competitive standpoint strategically against my key competitors? And so the thought was that actually on the financial piece, even though it's hard to value patents and licensing activity, it's easier than a lot of things. So that is a low risk on return in terms of how you can look at it from the present time. And then in terms of defensive and risk value, again, there are a lot of questions in who is going to assert, what they're going to assert, and how well you're going to defend. So we view that to be kind of in a moderate risk category. And then finally, on the competitive value, you know, there aren't a lot of silver bullets out there. And, you know, how is the IP really going to be super impactful in an appropriate way that helps you to get to market faster than someone else? The idea here is that's a high risk on return. And I'm sorry that the desk is in the way. But at the bottom of the slide, basically it takes a patent purchase and it says, okay, I invested X, and based on my financials, I know that I have, you know, this amount of money that we think it's going to be. So it's $50 million in. This is a totally made-up number. You'd never, I haven't bought a patent for $50 million yet. But at any rate, $50 million in. $10 million in a licensing stream. We think $30 million, and this will have churned on a percentage that is different from the percentage on this, that gets you to the $30 million that says that's what we're going to avoid in terms of a judgment payment. We're going to save $16 million from a risk of having to redesign or do something to the thing. And then finally, we could potentially have as much as $65 million as a competitive value. And so what does this say? It says, wow, that's so high risk. It's not so likely to happen. And even factoring in the risk, and by the way, this then goes through the algorithm to get to the total net present value, and it will include the time, the life of the patent, and a variety of these other factors like citation, all those things. Crunch it together, you get a net present value, and you say, wow, if I don't get competitive benefit from this, this is a stupid thing to buy. So say what it is. Everybody's got a secret sauce that's like this, not everybody, but a lot of players are thinking about how to evaluate patents in different ways, and ours is the Moneyball way.
No, the question I'm asking is orthogonal to that question.
Okay.
You go through all of these inputs. The question is, why do you choose the form of the transaction as it is? That is, an outright purchase of a Bayer patent as opposed to an exclusive license and so forth. Now, I can understand why you don't use non-exclusive licenses
right.
Under these things, because that gives you no right with respect to the resale part of the market. When you buy these things, do you only buy them for cash? Do you buy them on time? Do you buy them where the price will vary depending upon your reuse or something like that? I'm just curious as to what the structure is.
Yeah, there are a variety, and that's interesting. You know, perhaps I should spend some time and add a little part to the paper that talks about some of the structures, because I haven't spent a lot of time on that, partly because Microsoft has cash, so we're more likely to spend the cash on something now. But there are arrangements by which we get, you know, when we sell a patent, that we are going to get a return later. To your point, they can take any variety of forms. And, you know, I think the cash form is most common. And the reason I think the cash form is most common is that people want to be done with it and have it. And that's why, and I'll discuss very briefly, and I've got to stop, why I think that these transactions are so hard to do. In terms of making sure that the file history's there, that the title's there. They want to be done with it. That's the beauty of a sale versus a license, you know. It's mine. I know what it is, warts and all. It's mine, and I can do it. And that's this new marketplace where people are going out. And then why do we sell? Well, to extract value at a particular time. Why do we buy for defensive and risk avoidance purposes or potentially to add to a portfolio we have to a license? So.
What percentage of the things you buy do you actually
re-license? I don't know the answer to that. We haven't, you know, it's not like we've bought tons. We're not a huge player in this marketplace in buying. I don't remember during my tenure having something that made such a difference in our licensing offerings, and I don't think that anything since that time has been the case. Often you buy trying to be really smart about the future, so that may lend to enhance licensing in the future. But the technology may not be there yet. That's part of the way we think about buying.
One reason why market might evolve more towards sales and licenses is because the transaction cost of a license is so much greater. There's so much complexity in mm-hmm. a license. And if you're going to do a sequence of transactions, the complexity, building on the complexity, probably just makes it impossible.
The other explanation is if you want an affirmative revenue stream out of it, and you think you might have to enforce your patent
yep.
to get that, even exclusive licenses don't necessarily get you the right to bring a lawsuit to enforce
That's right.
those patents. And the law on whether or not they do is complex and far from transparent.
That's right.
That's what I
was saying. I'm sorry. That's right. So let me just kind of get close to the end here with just saying we've talked about the contextual nature of valuation. We've briefly talked about transparency and that kind of nobody, you know, really kind of wants it. I guess I would observe, I don't think we need it. Licensing has worked perfectly fine without a ton of transparency, and there's not a ton of transparency. In fact, licensing transactions, you know, are materially disclosed in very few areas. And yet the market for licensing seems to be working pretty well. There aren't, you know, licensing avoids lawsuits if it's done right, and it transacts with technology and patents pretty effectively. And so that's one point. The other point is there was a paper by a man called Kevin Dubiansky, and he was talking about venture capital and how, you know, if you think patent sales, listen, at least you can see the patent. You know, it's the file. There are a lot of public things about patents. When you're investing in a venture capital startup, you really don't know that much. And so if people can do that with big amounts of money, why can't they do that here? And I guess I would say that I actually think that that's right. I think as people learn, we'll be able to get better and closer to some of those more transparent marketplaces. But right now, part of the reason why people don't want to be transparent is there's so much learning to do, and they feel they have an advantage if they're advancing in their learning. But transparency in the transaction is a problem because the brokers are in the middle and oftentimes representing both sides. And that is challenging. And you don't necessarily feel that you get to see the fullness of what's going on with that broker in the marketplace. And a number of people I've spoken to have used the word ethics and thinking about, you know, is this really, are we transacting in the most effective way possible? But I think there's self-help available here. So when you enter into your deal with your broker, you can say, fella, I'm not. If you're getting money from anybody else, I'm not paying you. Or, you know, we're not. I'm not interested in that. I want to be the person that pays you, and I'll pay you my 15, 20, 25%. But I don't want to have you getting money from someone else. I want you loyal to me. I mean, there's just no duty of loyalty for these brokers in this marketplace.
Can I push you a little bit on this? We don't need transparency.
Yeah.
Piece, right? Because you are the first person I've heard say, do you think the licensing market is working well? There is a market, there's no question, right, which you've talked about it, but it seems to me actually it's an awfully thin market, and one of the reasons it's a thin market is precisely that we don't actually know what the price of any of the other things is, right? So it's almost as though we were running a stock exchange, but nobody could find out what price anyone else bought a share of stock at. Right? You would still have transactions, mm-hmm. so you could look at those transactions and say, oh yeah, the market's working. But it clearly wasn't working as well as it would if we could know what other people were buying and selling for. And to me, evidence that it's not working all that well is the value spread between the purchases in these various markets and the uses that are made of these patents. Right. So if people are buying up patents for $20,000 or $30,000, or even for $1 million, and then plunking several million dollars into enforcing them in hopes of hitting a 100 million plus verdict, mm-hmm. right? There's a real information asymmetry there, right? The patent's either worth that much or it isn't. And I think the problem is we're not getting real pricing because we don't know.
This is why it's so complicated. One of the differences with licensing is pure patent licensing is not as common as broader licensing that's carrying technology with it, which obscures very much the value. And that is the bulk of the licensing. Let me tell you, that's so much more valuable and interesting and enhances even more the collaboration between companies.
But I think it's not the bulk of NPE licensing.
No, it's not the bulk of NPE licensing. That is pure patent licensing. I take your point there. But then going to this idea about the transparency, again, you're back to the sui generis nature of patents. So yes, you can say that there's this value out there, and I am saying that today, that people are saying, okay, low value patents are this and this is that. But when it comes to the high value ones, there's just a lot of complexity in each valuation that to say one is going to so inform the other, you know, I guess the lawsuits could confirm that better than anything else.
Well, okay, so all right, so stock, so you don't like the stock exchange because that is more of a high value part. How about real estate? Right.
Yep.
Surely we would not have as liquid a real estate market if you couldn't find out what other houses in your neighborhood sold for.
Yeah.
Right.
I can tell you, Microsoft is one of the players who's comfortable with, you know, when we sell a patent and we buy a patent, we do it in our own name. Almost no one else does.
They use
other entities, or they just don't record the sale.
Mark, are you pushing for mandated disclosure? Is that right?
Oh, but I mean, isn't it possible? I mean, you know, there's this great line in the Untouchables movie, since we're in Chicago, and I have a terrible Sean Connery accent, so I won't try it. But
we have a couple of minutes, so
you get a lot further
with
a kind word and a gun than you do with just a kind word, and so aren't all of these debates simply about likelihood of successful enforcement, and all other things being equal, the hugest kind of factor in valuation is, can somebody believe that this patent will get enforced against a particular defendant who is not likely to be bankruptcy remote and is likely to pay a large amount of money? And unless you can think with a high degree of confidence that far down the decision tree, everybody else in the game is pricing these, and I'm sorry, Mark, I don't think they're thinking at all about real estate analogies. I don't think they're thinking at all about stock market analogies. I think they're thinking simply about transaction costs of litigation.
I actually think that's probably right, as much as people have wanted to talk about real estate analogies and you know, IP mercantile exchange for patents.
And can I ask you, who among market actors wants more transparency? I mean, because law professors, who cares?
That's right. I mean, everybody wants the transparency. Nobody wants to give the transparency.
Right. I think lots of people would love to have transparency or everyone else. No one's going to do it voluntarily when no one else does it. Exactly.
Dilemma situation.
This is precisely why, as in the securities context, we need a mandate.
All right. Well, you need a coordinating action.
Well, I mean, again, I think that what we're going to see is that the marketplace, as it evolves, there's going to be more transparency just because there's going to be more transactions, there's going to be more experience, people will have dealt with each other, and that's increasing now, and the brokers are the people who have most of the knowledge. Let's put it that way. The brokers have that. So that goes back to this piece of the brokers, and, you know, can we put some more on the brokers to either operate in a way that is more arm's length in certain ways, that protects the fairness of the transaction, and or not abuse the transparency that they have. I'm going to just kind of say one thing about lawyers.
God help us.
I think I come by this honestly. I was an English major at Berkeley. I have a scientific bone in my body, and I ran that patent licensing business and the cross-licensing, and I did a pretty good job. And I will tell you that my observation then is that of a non-patent attorney. The problem in this marketplace is that, to Scott's point, X person is totally bullish that we're going to kill with this patent, and X patent lawyer is totally bullish that we will get out from under it. And the mentality, they don't have that mentality that we had to develop in the cross-licenses, which just says, let's look at this in a balanced way. I mean, yeah, there's this chance or that chance. So I do think your money ball approaches, and some of this is important, but at the end of the day, it's about the quality of the evaluation you get, the vetting, if you will. I'm not going to continue here, but
are
in
you
my...
a lawyer?
Yeah, I am that.
That's right.
But the patent lawyers are a different breed, with all respect to every single one of them in the room. Anyway, bottom line is, when you get into the transaction, I'm just going to say the titles of these. I have explored it a little bit more in my draft, and when you see it, good title arises in 70 to 80% of transactions, according to the practitioners, and it's a problem. You know, you want a no surprises file history. It's a painful, this is more about resources than it is about how to, but oh my God, it is just a painful thing. And it's hard when you have a big portfolio and you don't know till the last days which patents somebody's going to want to take to really get that wrapped up. So there are some self-help things that you have to think about of sequencing your transaction and the transfer of title and what can unroll your transaction. Encumbrance is the single biggest, most important problem, and I wish I had more time to talk about that, but it does bring in some of the LG Quanta issues. For a company like ours, when we are selling a patent and they say, okay, well, fine, but you know, you're selling a product, your grant back gives it back to you, but I don't want anybody else to have it because I want to be able to go against you guys. Well, we want to be able to sell a product that can be combined with a computer, thank you very much. So there are a lot of issues in the negotiation around that. And finally, you know, I think that there are also issues after the transaction. How do we handle litigation and how we support things? How do we find, you know, how do we find the inventors, back to title, to make sure that we can cure something? What access do people have? So what are the post-transaction transaction obligations and costs? And these are the things that people spend a lot of time on. And with that, we've had a lot of dialogue, and I think I'm way into the next session. And Mark's paper is so interesting, so I'm sitting down fast.